So we are at the end of Perek Zayin, the end of chapter 7. And we have some very interesting things. I find them interesting to discuss today. We're at the bottom of page 1853. If you're using the stone Tanakh, one note just to follow up from last time, the question was asked whether Ezra and Nehemiah appear in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the answer is that fragments of Ezra do appear from the middle chapters. I haven't seen anything of Nehemiah, but the middle chapters of Ezra are indeed found there. I think the question was asked in the context of why we have these two different lists and what would show up in the version there. But the chapters that I've seen are from later than the initial list from the beginning of Ezra and don't include what you're seeing here in Nehemiah. Okay, that's just wrapping up that point from last time. In terms of the ending here in chapter 7, sentences 69 to 71, Samach Tet to Ayin Aleph. So these are the donations which were recorded first in Ezra, the end of chapter 2, and then here, they're recorded here in the end of chapter 7. And again, I'm not going through the text inside, but there are big differences between the two in terms of what's listed for the donations. It's actually worth it just to take a fast look, just to see what we're talking about. So if you look back in Ezra on page 1819 in the Stone Tanakh, and just look at it quickly.
What's the chapter
2? Yes, chapter 2, yeah. Sentences 68 to 70. That's on the one hand. And then here in Nehemiah, you're in chapter 7, 69 to 71. You see that?
Yeah.
So in the version of it that appears back in Ezra, we're told Merashei Ha'avot, some of the heads of the families, when they came to the temple, to the Beis HaMikdash, they donated, and what they gave were, as you see, 61,000 darkimon, whatever a darkimon is, of gold, and then a certain measure of silver, and then they gave the ketonet, they gave the tunics for the kohanim. That's what they gave there. And you contrast that with what you see in Nehemiah in the list, where we're told again, Miktsat Rashi Ha'avot, some of the heads of household gave for the work, but then we're told that Tirshata gave, the Tirshata again being the governor, which we associate with Nehemiah. And the amounts that are given are different as well. I'm not going to belabor it by going into the specific changes, but the sums change, and we add a Tirshata gift, which didn't appear in the first list. And it's not that the first list is unaware of the Tirshata, because the Tirshata shows up in the middle of that list as the one who instructs the Kohanim who don't have lineage that they should not serve in the temple. So why do the donations change? So two different approaches. Take a look at your source sheet. For those who just came in, you missed a note on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but we're in the donations, the discrepancies at the end of the list. So in source 1, on your sheet, Ralbag gives you one answer, Malbim gives you two other approaches. Ralbag says, Vihine, Hanedavoshen is Karos Po, the gifts that are mentioned here in Nehemiah, Enon Maskimos, Gamkin, Linedavos, and Iskaros Sham, they don't match. Just like we have problems with names and numbers in the population, the donations don't fit the Ezra list either. Kivakan Zachar, Mikosnos, Akoanim, Yosem, Imasha, Zachar, Sham, here there are more tunics that are donated, Umishar, Devram, Pachos, and there are less of other items. So Ralbag says, Vyidme, Kivakan Zachar, Ktsasa, Pratim, Bishmiktsas, mentioned some things, omitted others, deal with it. He doesn't seem terribly bothered by the fact that there is a discrepancy between the lists. As far as he's concerned, Nehemiah wasn't taking care to copy the list verbatim. That's Ralbag. Malbim wouldn't be able to sleep at night if he said that. He has to offer you some kind of a justification. So he offers us two justifications. Source number 2. He says, Yesh Lomar, you could say, she's Nadu Shtei Pe'amim. You could say that there actually were two different sets of donations. Especially because, as he continues to say, he has already written that the list in Ezra 2 and the list in Nehemiah 7 are two different lists of people. Right? He said that the list in Ezra 2, I'm going to say it outside of the text here to make it more clear. He said the list in Ezra 2 was just the Jews who had been exiled to the capital city of Babel, who we assumed were the elites from the first exile of the Jews. So those Jews who came back, those are the ones who are listed on the first list. Whereas the second list includes those who had been exiled to other parts of the Babylonian Empire. It's a broader population. So he says that's why the donations look different. Maybe the donations listed in Nehemiah 7 are from a second round of donations, which also included donations from the Tirshatha, the governor, a.k.a. Nehemiah probably. And that's why you see a discrepancy between the lists. That's one approach. Alternatively, he offers you another idea, that maybe the second donation was actually a much later donation. It's from when Nehemiah showed up in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. So maybe that's the way to resolve it. Everyone is attentive to it. You can't miss it. It's very clear that there's a problem. But the answers range from Ralbag shrugging to Malbim attempting to provide a logic-based explanation for it. But that's the end of these lists. We are now officially done with them. Unless you wanted to discuss it further, Debbie. You were going to say?
I was looking at my notes from last week, but I couldn't find it. Did Robot comment on the fact that the list of people, the censuses were different?
So,
the one who said, so what? Who said so what?
No, Matsudat David said so what.
I was just wondering.
Yeah, no. Ralbag in general on Ezra and Nehemiah doesn't have a whole lot to say for the most part. He doesn't really say much. Matsudat David is the one who says, yeah, changes come up. Don't worry about it. Let's get on to the story. That's more or less his attitude there. It does sound like drachma. I keep thinking that as I read it, and I don't know if any of the translations actually render it that way. Right. Well, art school doesn't surprise me. They would. They do. They say drachma. Okay. Drachma it is. That brings us to one note of, again, when I say the word chronology, don't fall asleep. It's actually a really interesting question, believe me. You'll see. Go to the last sentence in Perek Zayin, the last sentence in Nehemiah chapter 7, and we're going to compare it to the last sentence in Ezra chapter 2, first sentence in Ezra chapter 3. And you'll see what I mean instantly. So in Nehemiah, you want to be on page 1855 at the top. In Ezra, you want to be on page 1819. The end of the list in Ezra, let's do Ezra first, because, you know, that was the earlier one in our studies. We're told that at the end of chapter 2, the Kohanim, the Levium, the singers, the gatekeepers, the Netinim are all in their cities. V'chol Yisrael ba'arehem, and all Israel are in their cities. And then Vayigah Chodesh Hashvi'i, the seventh month arrived. U'bnei Yisrael be'arim, and the Jews collectively are in their cities. That was the end of the list, and then we went on from there to talk about how they built a Mizbeach. They didn't have a Beis HaMikdash yet. There was no temple. But they built an altar, and they began bringing offerings in the seventh month, which is, of course, Tishrei, the month of Rosh Hashanah, and they celebrated Sukkot, and we made a big deal out of that. Because we said that Ezra wants to dedicate the Mizbeach in the month of Tishrei and on Sukkot to parallel Shlomo's Beis HaMikdash. Because that was what Shlomo did with the Beis HaMikdash. He dedicated it also same time of year. Remember the 1 week and 1 week with the celebration of the Beis HaMikdash first and then celebration of Sukkot. So that was what happened in Ezra, end of chapter 2. We're told after the list, everybody is dwelling in their cities and the seventh month arrives. And then you get the Mizbeach and so on. Now look at the end of Nehemiah's list. The very last verse, top page 1855. We're told, once again, the Kohanim, the Levium, the gatekeepers, the singers, the Netinim, they're all in their cities. Vayigah HaChodesh HaShvi'i, the seventh month arrived, uvnei Yisrael ba'arehem. And the children of Israel were settled in their cities. So, my question to you, is that just this was on the list from, you know, that we copied more or less from, right? We got all our names, we got all our numbers off of this list, and that was the last line on the list, and therefore when we copied it over we included that as well? Or is it actually that whatever's going on in Nehemiah now is happening in the seventh month? Which is it? Is there any way to know? How would you know? Well, logically, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for you to copy that sentence if it's not what's going on now. Right? It's sort of like a kid who, you know, copies somebody else's essay and then accidentally copies their name. Right? At the top. It's a bad idea. Like, this isn't part of the list. If Nehemiah wants to do a census in order to get to do his lottery to decide who's going to live in Yerushalayim, let him copy the names, let him copy the numbers, and then move on. Why copy the sentence at the bottom that says all rights reserved? Like, that's what he's done. It doesn't make any sense. Debbie and then Dahlia.
GPS says these words are missing from some of the manuscripts.
Yes.
These words are missing.
Yes.
In some of the manuscripts.
Yes. There are manuscript issues in general in Nehemiah chapter 7, and they and maybe that points to something, but I don't know what it points to.
I don't know either, but it's...
It points to somebody with an eraser who looked at this and said, yeah, that doesn't belong, let me erase it.
Someone retake it out. That's how it's said. We'll take it out.
Yes. Dahlia, you were going to say?
No, I was just going to say that's why people have, you know, do all this Bible criticism.
Yeah,
because stuff like this that we could
get. Right, it's a sign of a mistake.
Right.
Right. The problem with it, as my teacher Moshe Bernstein likes to say, is that the as he put it, the if you accept the documentary hypothesis, which isn't this, but if you accept the documentary hypothesis, then you also accept the theory of evolution, because if this was really edited, it must have been by a monkey. In the sense that the texts that have to be patched together, I didn't get the same laugh as I thought.
No, because you can accept the theory of evolution.
That's not his point. He's making a joke.
I know.
This has nothing to do with evolution per se.
Yeah.
His point is that realistically, this would be the worst editing job in history. The fact that you would edit together different manuscripts so poorly, and when you're looking at both of them in front of you, it defies explanation. You can explain certain things. You can say, well, they preserved different names of God because this was one that they didn't want to offend. This was the other. They wanted to co-opt different groups. But it really falls apart when you see them, you know, when you see the same biblical sentence say Yaakov and Yisrael, and the next one just Yaakov, the next one just Yisrael, to explain that manuscripts were patched together in order to create that really pushes the imagination. But take a look on your sheet at source number 3, and I'll show you how this problem plays out. This took me a long time to try to sort everything out. I hope it'll be worthwhile. I brought you first the passages that are relevant from Ezra. In Ezra chapter 1, Cyrus, King Cyrus the Great, right, Cyrus the Second, allowed Zerubbabel to lead the Jews, not just allowed, charged Zerubbabel really, with leading a group of Jews to go back to Israel and to build the Beis HaMikdash. That's Ezra chapter 1. Then we had a census of Zerubbabel's Aliyah. That's the part I bolded there, Ezra 2. Then the opening sentence of chapter 3, the seventh month arrived. And then the people observed Sukkot as recorded in the Torah with Karbonot. Everything I bolded there is going to show up as well in Nehemiah. So when you look at the Nehemiah list, in the beginning of chapter 7, we saw Nehemiah say, you know, we need to populate the city. It's sparse. There aren't people to defend it. If there's an invasion, we're not going to. We won't be aware of it. Won't be able to rally against it. So he says, "I need to populate Yerushalayim," and he orders a census. And we have a reprint of the census from Zerubbabel's Aliyah, as we said last week. It's somewhat altered, perhaps updated, depending on whose explanation you adopted. Then the seventh month arrived, and the Jews were in their cities. And then the following weird thing happens. Ezra holds a public Torah reading. That's what's going to be the focus of chapter 8. Ezra's going to do a big public Torah reading. Ezra and Nehemiah are going to bless the people. We're going to see them actually working in tandem. Then the people are going to learn about Sukkot. They're going to read from the Torah and find out, hey, there's this thing called Sukkot. What do you know? And they're going to build Sukkot. And then there's going to be this big national religious revival. They're going to agree once again to accept the Torah. This is also going to involve an element about intermarriages in there in chapters 9 and 10. And then, only then, in chapter 11, will Nehemiah hold his lottery to assign 10% of the population to live in Yerushalayim. So you start to see that we have an issue here. We have multiple issues actually going on here. And I'm going to try to explain this in as painless a way as possible. The passage that runs from Nehemiah chapter 7, sent in 72, through Nehemiah chapter 8, really sentence 18. The part that includes the people are in their cities in the seventh month, and Ezra holds a public Torah reading, and the people observe Sukkot. Did that occur in Zerubbabel's day? Did that occur in that first generation of Jews who came back to the land? Because it looks an awful lot like that. Census, seventh month, people are in their cities. We observe Sukkot. Or is it just coincidental? And in fact, this is from the day of Nehemiah. Even though it looks an awful lot like it's an extension of that list that was copied from the beginning, it's actually a separate story. Which way would you read it?
Apart from anything else, the different terms of the actual date of the gathering from Ezra, it's implied in terms of Sukkot, and then Nehemiah is Rosh Hashanah.
Well, Rosh Hashanah gets mentioned, but then Sukkot is mentioned as well in the in that story. It's not right at the beginning. It's true. But can you tell me when the events in Nehemiah, are they reflective of what happened in the first generation, or it sounds like you're leaning to the idea that this is actually a separate story in Nehemiah's day? Neither one of these explanations works well. There are problems with each. All right, I'll bite. You could take the approach that it's all from the earlier generation. The whole thing that we're going to read about, including the public reading of the Torah on Rosh Hashanah, including the celebration of Sukkot, look at that. Look what we found in this book. There's supposed to be a Sukkot holiday. All of that was actually in Zerubbabel's day. You could take that approach. But then you have two problems. Problem number one is, that means Ezra and Nehemiah were around in Zerubbabel's day. Ezra did the public Torah reading. We're going to put Ezra and Nehemiah back in the first generation? Then why was their arrival recorded later? Ezra doesn't show up until Ezra chapter 7. We made a big deal out of that. Right? It's a different king who sent him. Right? He was sent by Artaxerxes. Unless you're going to say Artaxerxes equals Cyrus. We'll come back to that.
Wouldn't they know about Sukkot if they learned about it back then?
So that's one of the questions we have to deal with in a moment when we deal with the second approach. But that's problem number one with this approach. What are Ezra and Nehemiah doing in Zerubbabel's generation in Israel? That's problem number one. Problem number two is, if this is really the same event, why is it that they look different? In Ezra, chapter 3, sentences 2 to 4, we talk about how they built the altar and they brought karbanot. They brought sacrifices for Sukkot. In Nehemiah, it's going to say they learned all about building Sukkot and they built Sukkot. Why are these accounts different? So those are my two problems with saying this story came from the first generation. But now let's look at it the other way. Let's say that you're right. This story actually occurred later. The census was reprinted, and then we go to Nehemiah's generation for the rest of the story taking place in Nehemiah's day. But then I have a problem. Problem number one is, why did you include the sentence of the Jews were in their cities and the seventh month arrived? Right? Pulling that from the original scroll. Problem number two, I don't understand what Nehemiah was doing. Look back at your chronology of events. Nehemiah has the census in order to hold his lottery. Oh, sorry guys. Wait, we have to stop. Seventh month arrives. So now we're going to do a big public Torah reading. Because why not? right? Because Ezra wanted to. It was on Ezra's schedule. So, all right, fine. We'll do the big public Torah reading, and then we're going to send everybody to Jerusalem. No, we're actually not. Then we have a public blessing of the people. Oh, then we have to observe Sukkot. Then we're going to have a national return to God and a renewal of our covenant, which is not on the calendar. It's not calendar-based. It's not like Tishrei came, the month came, and now we have to do it. And then in chapters 10 and 11, Nehemiah gets around to finally holding his lottery. Nehemiah isn't somebody who lets grass grow under his feet, right? He showed up in the land with a mission of building a wall, and within 3 days he had done his survey, and he's already dividing everybody up. Why in the world would he have stalled with this census in order to, with a lottery in order to populate Yerushalayim? That's another problem. Third problem.
With that problem, you're saying that it didn't happen in his generation?
I'm saying if you hold that it did happen in his generation, right. if this is just porting in an earlier story, I'm good. All that happened way back when, and we're just recording it now.
So to that answer that question is it was really just a retelling of something that happened.
Correct. And then my problem is just that Ezra and Nehemiah weren't there. That's all.
Okay. Who read the Torah?
Right. I mean, it says Ezra read it. Maybe it was another Ezra. A third problem is, isn't that a strange parallel? If this is really what's happening in Nehemiah's day, that they're observing Sukkot, so it just happens to be that Zerubbabel did his census in the beginning of Ezra, and then the seventh month arrives, and the Jews observed Sukkot. And lo and behold, in Nehemiah's day also, they did a census to arrange to populate Yerushalayim, and then came Sukkot. It just worked out that way. That time of year is a magic time of year for censuses, and it's not unthinkable.
Well, maybe
it's just strange.
At a certain time when planting is and the farmers are in from their field. I mean, things in agrarian societies happen at particular times.
Right. Right.
So because if they're all coming in, have they not been doing Sukkot from the earlier time when they learned about it?
So that's one of the questions we're going to have to address. That question I'm going to hold until chapter 8 when we actually see the observance, because the question's going to be even worse. I'll show you how bad the question's going to be, because that's fun. Take a look at 1855, chapter 8, sentence... No, sorry, it's the top of the next page. You want chapter 8, sentence 17. Page 1857. You see that? Vayasu kol hakahal hashavim and hashavi sukkot. Vayishvu basukkot. Everybody who had come back from exile made sukkot, and they dwelled in the sukkot. Ki lo asu mimei Yoshua ben Nun kein bnei Yisrael ad hayom ahu. They hadn't done anything like that since the days of Yoshua. There was an awful lot of years by the time of Yoshua. No one observed sukkot. I mean, King David never sat in a sukkah. That would just destroy that line, right? Harachmanu yakim et sukkah beit David anopal, right?
Also, granted, it's tomorrow. We have all the stories of
Well, that's second base Hamikdash. That second temple, that was after this.
Oh, that's after. Oh, you're right.
Yeah, for that part, it's good. So when we get to chapter 8, we have to find out what in the world is going on. Why was Sukkot not in the handbook? Is that just skipped in Hebrew school because they spent so much time teaching about Rosh Hashanah and dipped the apple in the honey and then Yom Kippur and there just was no chance to get around to Sukkot and then the kids went on break? Yeah, we'll get there. We will get to that issue.
The Ezra story, the whole atmosphere is the Ema Aleihem, I don't see that mentioned in the Nehemiah story.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of differences between them.
But that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm. By the way, that sentence that we just read, the one from chapter 8, sentence 17, when it said in the beginning of the sentence, all those who came back from the captivity made Sukkot, that makes it sound like this is an earlier story. Because by Nehemiah's day, they've been back for decades. Do they still call themselves that? The people who had come back from captivity? It really sounds much more like this is an event that happened earlier, not an event that happened later. But one other question you have to ask, and this does feed into what we just read, which is, if you're going to tell me they observed Sukkot in Ezra's day, then why was this whole thing a surprise in Nehemiah's time? Not in Ezra's day, I'm sorry, in Zerubbabel's day. If in Zerubbabel's day they did it, granted, it's been a long time, it's been decades, but it didn't make it sound like that. It made it sound like from the days of Yehoshua. So I'm very confused in terms of what I'm supposed to do with the story that we're about to read. So the truth of the matter is that both answers are pursued by Malbim. Malbim tries both tacks, and he ends up preferring the second one. He prefers the idea that this is actually a separate story in Nehemiah. It's not the same as the story in Ezra. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 4. He gives you the first approach first. He says, Yesh Omrim, some say, Shehu Hemsheikh Shel Hadvarim Shahayu Ba'aliyah Rishona Shayavime Koresh. Some say that when the text says that we're in their cities, the seventh month, the whole bit, it's just continuing the account of what happened in Zerubbabel's day, in Cyrus's day. When chapter 7 started with Nehemiah reporting what he found in the book of lineage, Nimshach ad Sof Kapitel Yud. That actually runs until the end of chapter 10 in Nehemiah. All these things, the covenant, the return to God, the public Torah reading, all happened back in the day of Zerubbabel. So there. That's his first approach. Which means that Ezra actually came to Israel twice. And guess what? So did Nehemiah. They went to the land. They were there for a while. They left. And then made a repeat trip. And he says, after all, we read this. I made a point of it last week. In the census, when we talked about the Kohanim who couldn't prove their lineage, we said that Tirshatha said that they should not serve. Nehemiah is the Tirshatha. It makes it sound like he was already there back in Zerubbabel's day. There were other ways we could read that sentence, but that's what he says that you should read it as. Not only that, in chapter 12, we are going to see Ezra listed along those who came with Zerubbabel. We already talked about that with some of the name changes and the name of Azariah. That could be the Ezra. And then everything works. The holiday of Sukkot that they celebrated, as it is written back in Ezra, is the same as the one that they celebrate in the book of Nehemiah. That's his first approach. So this idea that this is just a repeat of what happened in Zerubbabel's day relies on saying that Ezra and Nehemiah were there the first time. If you flip the page for a minute to source number 5, I bring you a Gemara that supports this idea.
But he doesn't deal with the fact that we don't know that it's Ezra coming, that whole thing. Are we just ignoring that?
No, we're not ignoring it. That's why I bring you these Gemara. Malbim ignores it.
Okay.
But I am not ignoring it.
Okay.
Take a look at source number 5, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Shaltiel, it's talking about a pasuk, a verse that lists a few different people. Shaltiel, Zerubbabel, and Nehemiah. And says it's actually all one person. There was one person who went by multiple names. Shaltiel Shenishal al alato Kael, because God repealed his vow. Because this person we're talking about is the descendant of King Yechoniah. King Yechoniah, one of the last kings of Judea, about whom God said he will not have a descendant. God repeals that vow and allowed him to have this descendant. His name is also Zerubbabel, Shenizra Bibavel, because he was conceived in Babylon before Yechoniah went into exile. But you want to know what his name really is? Mashemo, Nehemiah ben Hakalia Shemo. Nehemiah is Zerubbabel. So when you read that Gemara, if you learn Sanhedrin, you read that Gemara and just think, wow, that's really funny. This is part of the biblical law of conservation of personalities, right? In which we just assume that everybody is everybody else, right? You've seen this before. Idea that Bilam is Lavan, right? Is one popular one. We do that with people in Tanakh for a variety of reasons. So you don't realize what this Gemara is doing when you learn it in Sanhedrin. What the Gemara is doing is it's trying to solve our problem. Our Gemara, I believe, this Gemara here in source number 5, is motivated by the question of when did the events in Nehemiah show up? when was Nechemiah in the land? And it wants to argue that Nechemiah is there from the beginning. Well, then why isn't his name there? Because he's under a different name. He's operating under the name Zerubbabel at that stage. That's one Gemara. A second one is source number 6. Source number 6 will answer the question, Rebecca, of where Ezra was. Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman said, Malachi Zem Mordechai. Malachi, the Navi Malachi is a problem. Some of you, actually, none of you, maybe Tova, and maybe Dalia and Rebecca, actually, were here when we did Malachi. It's quite a few years ago at this point. But we studied Malachi, and we noted that the beginning of Malachi is different from the beginning of other Nevi'im, of other prophets. If you take a very fast look, it's worth noting it. It's page 1400 and... Masad Devar Hashem El Yisrael. This is the prophecy, the word of God to Israel. You see it? Biyad Malachi. In the hands of Malachi. Normally, in the beginning of a prophet's message, we get some kind of introduction of who they are. Here, there are even commentators who suggest Malachi is not his name. It means my agent, God's agent. This is the vision of God as presented by God's agent, his Malach. And then he just runs right into the prophecy, and we never find out anything about him beyond that. So once we see that he's introduced in this odd way, the Gemara says, you know, Malachi could actually be Mordechai, and he's called Malachi because he's an assistant to the Melech. Never mind that completely violates Hebrew grammar. There's an aleph in the word Malach that does not appear in the word Melech. Don't get hung up on things like that. They,
Malach an angel? Like Malach?
Yeah,
like,
Malach is an agent, someone who does a task for you.
Malach.
Yeah. Okay. Malach Shali. No, your Hebrew is perfect. Malach Shali. That's exactly right. A Malach is somebody who engages in Malacha, who performs a task. Whether it's angelic or whether it's human or anything else, doesn't matter. So that's one approach to who Malachi is. The Gemara then rejects the idea that Mordechai and Malachi are the same because they appear in the same verse. Mind you, that didn't stop us with Zerubbabel and Nechemiah, but the Gemara says, okay, fine. Then Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha comes along and says, Malachi is Ezra. In this source number 6. His real name was Malachi, but he was also known as Ezra. The logic of it, as it continues to explain, is that Malachi expresses his anger and frustration with the Jews, the Jewish men who have married non-Jewish women, just as Ezra does. We talked about this when we introduced Ezra way back when, and we said there are other associations between Malachi and Ezra as well. If you go back to your notes from the beginning of chapter 7, we talked about it then. I'm not going to do it right now. But one of the elements that this Gemara is trying to solve is, again, where is Ezra in the beginning of the story? If he is doing this big public Torah reading in Zerubbabel's day, where is he? The answer is, Ezra is Malachi, who is a prophet who we know operates in the time of of Zerubbabel. Malachi is the second generation of the first temple. So, he's around in those days. Okay. This, by the way, saying that Zerubbabel is Nechemiah helps solve another problem. Zerubbabel vanishes, right? He's the leader of that first aliyah, and then suddenly he's not there. And we don't know that he died, and we don't know where he went, and we don't know what happened to him. Maybe the answer is he didn't at all. He's Nehemiah. So that would be neat. So you could answer the question. You can answer the question of when did Ezra and Nehemiah show up, and suggest that they actually were indeed there in the beginning, and then they left. In terms of the question of why I have two different accounts of Sukkot, if it's the same holiday, the answer would be different focuses. Right? Foci for the technically, correct. The focus in Ezra at that stage, in Zerubbabel's time, is building the Mizbeach, building the altar, and then ultimately the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. So of course you focus on the sacrifices. The focus here in Nehemiah is about the people living life. And therefore, you want to talk about them leaving their houses to go live in Sukkot. two different facets of the same story. That would be the way to sustain this idea. If you flip back to the first side, that's Malbim's first approach. This whole section is just a repeat of what happens in Zerubbabel's day, but in fact, it's the same story. Then Malbim says, I have to be honest and bring you the other approach, which is Ralbag's approach as well. And he says, V'yesh Omrim, some say, this story was in fact in Nehemiah's day, after they built the wall. The reason why it borrowed the sentence of and it was the seventh month, whatever, was because it was a neat parallel. It was actually true. Yes, the census in Zerubbabel's day was done in the seventh month. And yeah, it matched what happened now. So he borrowed the sentence from there, but that's where the resemblance ends, and then everything afterwards is the new story. And when it says in Ezra that they performed Sukkot, meaning in Zerubbabel's day, that was with all of the different sacrifices, and it was with the four species, with the lulav and esrog, and so on. The hagam shlo kimu az mitzvah sukkah karaoi, but they did not actually have Sukkot. In the first time round, in the days of Zerubbabel, they did not sit in the sukkah. So writes Malbim. And he says, you know what? He says, following the text, I think this is right. He goes with this latter view that this story is a later story. That's his way to read it. If so, we still have to answer a couple of questions. Why did Nehemiah wait until after the public Torah reading and after Sukkot and after the covenant and everything else? Right? Why in the world did he wait for that in order to populate Yerushalayim? What would you say?
I think there was always a problem of how to provide shelter for the people who were coming to that area to celebrate Sukkot.
Okay.
So maybe there were, I don't know if the Sukkot themselves came with the people or provided by
that would be clever.
The temple, or I don't know what happened, but last week, you said something about the empty space in Jerusalem, and he's already thinking of how to build houses or something, so that those people who got to live there had that special privilege of providing for those who would come.
Right, so that's a great idea, right? It makes sense to wait till after Sukkot, in which case you now have the space. And you don't have the issue of having just moved 10% of the population into the city. The only downside is, he doesn't do it right after Sukkot. He waits to get two more chapters. They're going to do a national covenant. This is the whole story that's going to happen afterwards. So there's still something. He's got to explain why he's waiting that long. Rebecca.
So really, why did the census and the division have, why are they separated?
Correct.
The census should have been afterwards. I
yeah.
That's...
And even then, then move your census to after Sukkot.
Right, move the census to after Sukkot. And then the two of them are together and there's a logic.
Right. So I think the answer may be he simply needs to get people on board. It's one thing to say you're going to build a wall and get all the area people to volunteer to build the wall. Right? It's one thing to say that you're going to arrange civil defense. It's another thing to go tell the population 10% of you are moving to Jerusalem. And it's the 10% I'm picking by lottery. Good luck.
So after Yontif, they might be more enthusiastic.
Not after Yontif, although Yontif definitely helps. It builds a sense of camaraderie. I think that is part of it. But more, it's the national covenant that comes afterwards. The reacceptance of the Torah and his leadership. I think he needs that in order to be able to do this population shift, which is going to bring with it a list of who's moving.
But that doesn't answer the question of why the census took place. So
why did he do the census so soon? I don't know. It's a good question. Then why do the census earlier? That I don't know. I will say this, though. And this goes to the question of the parallels being so interesting that one story has Sukkot in it and the other story has Sukkot in it. It fits. In Ezra chapter 3, we said that they started with the Karbanot at the time of Sukkot to parallel the dedication of the first temple, the first Beit HaMikdash. Well, here, remember our sequence of events. Nehemiah chapter 5 saw a military assault by the Samaritans. Right? When do you do your military assaults in the Middle East? Sorry? Warm weather.
Warm weather.
You always know that the increased risk of war with Hezbollah or war in Gaza or whatever it is always when you hit June. That's when this historically has been an issue. Once they have roads, once the mud has dried up, that's when the assaults take place. That's Nehemiah chapter 5. Then chapter 6, the people came to Nehemiah and complained about their finances. Right? They said, we're stuck, we have the debts. And then after that, it's legitimate to say you could have. Once he resolved that, Sukkot came up in Nehemiah 7 and 8. It could be that that's the way it worked. And not only that, it just occurs to me now, Ibn Ezra said with the forgiving of the loans, that that was actually the Shemitah year. Right? Ibn Ezra said it was a Shemitah forgiving of the loans. The loans are forgiven, Rosh Hashanah, at the end of the Shemitah year. It would fit to say that this actually worked very well. That fed right into Sukkot after that time. That would actually work really nicely with Ibn Ezra's idea. Okay. So,
what did they do with that statement that this was the first Sukkot since the times of Joshua
being done? We're going to get to that when we see chapter 8. When we see chapter 8, we're going to deal with it. Short answer is, as Ellen said, but we have more to say.
That's a cliffhanger.
Yeah. So, we have to come back to it. Without a doubt, that's on our agenda. But that's the upshot here. So what we now understand, I think, is that after the census, we have a story about a public Torah reading, a celebration of Sukkot, and a national covenant, which either was ported in from Zerubbabel in the first generation, and even though we didn't get a lot of this in the story then, we're going to get the story now. And Ezra and Nehemiah really showed up in the beginning and then came back later. That's one way to read it. The other way to read it is to say, no, happens to be that was Sukkot, this involves Sukkot also, but they're completely different stories. And Malbim prefers the latter view, and I think now we've seen a little bit of the logic involved. That brings us to Perek Chet, to chapter 8, which is a lot easier to read. It actually has a narrative, has a story. It's pleasant. Remember, chapter 3, Nehemiah built the wall. Chapter 4, attacks by the Samaritans and their allies, civil defense is arranged. Chapter 5, economic steps to help the needy, forgiving of the debts. Chapter 6, attempts on Nehemiah himself, trying to lure him out of the city, getting him to hide in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. The elevation of Tovia by his allies, Tovia being a bad guy, we do not like him. The wall is now complete. Chapter 7, he sets up the rules for administering the walls. When are the gates going to be open? When are the gates going to be closed? Need to populate Yerushalayim and the census. And now we get this narrative. And the themes of this chapter are the following. First of all, major theme, spiritual revival is possible. The people should not give up hope of growth. And Rosh Hashanah is positioned here as a time of national renewal in a very significant way. Another major point here, Ezra and Nehemiah working together. We haven't seen Ezra's name in this book, right? We've managed to get from Nehemiah chapter 1 into Nehemiah chapter 8, and Ezra nowhere to be seen, even though presumably he's still around. Now suddenly he's going to return and work with Nehemiah. And a major question here, which obviously is going to come back to us with Sukkot primarily, is what is the level of Jewish knowledge and practice among the Jews at this stage? Whether it's the first generation or whether it's, you know, after the wall is built. So what we'll see, as I outlined for you in source number 7, is a public Torah reading, a great pep talk on Rosh Hashanah, And then the celebration of Sukkot. So let's get started on this story. Chapter 8, sentence 1, you're on page 1855 if you're using the stone Tanakh. And we'll take a look at the first few sentences. The whole nation gathered as one to the plaza in front of the water gate. And they told Ezra the Sofer, Sofer as always can mean scribe or can mean scholar, they told him to bring the book of the Torah of Moshe, which God had commanded Israel. Ezra the Kohen, it's funny that we suddenly remembered he's a Kohen. We haven't talked about that at all since he showed up. But Ezra the Kohen brings the Torah in front of the nation, men and women. That's a tricky phrase to translate. Right now I'll just do what the Art Scroll does here. All those who could listen with understanding. But we're going to have to come back to that. To that phrase, because it's not straightforward. The Biyom Echad LaChodesh HaShavi'i, on the first day of the seventh month, a.k.a. Rosh Hashanah. Vayikravo Lifnei HaRachov Asher Lifnei Shar Hamayim, and he read from it in front of the plaza that is before the water gate, Min HaOr Ad Machzis Hayom, from first light until midday. Neged ha'anashim v'hanashim v'hamavinim, opposite the men, the women, those who would understand, v'aznei chal ha'am el sefer ha'torah, and the ears of the nation were turned to the Torah scroll. Finally, v'yamod Ezra sofer ha'migdal eitz asher asu ladavar. Ezra stood on a great big wooden platform they had made for this purpose. V'yamod etzlo matisya v'shema v'anaya v'uriya v'chilkiyo masaya al yemino. We get six people standing on his right, umismolo, and on his left, Pedayo, Mishaelo, Malkiya, v'chashum v'chash badana zacharya mishulam. On his left there are how many people? Seven is what it sounds like. We're going to come back to that, not this week probably, but next week. But that's our initial account of the Torah reading. There's more to come, starting in Pasuk Hey. But I want to pause with that and ask, what is strange in this story so far? What do we have to ask about here?
Well, who are the Medinim? A different category.
Right. What is this category of Mivinim? That's one question. What else?
What made them ask?
What made them ask? Whose initiative was this? Right? This is so reminiscent of what happened in the story with the intermarriages also. The people came to Ezra and said that the leaders have married out among the among whoever, right? That was a debate. But the people came to Ezra. Ezra then sat on the ground and cried and tore his clothing and fasted. And then the people said, we should do something about this. And now, once again, it's the people who come to Ezra rather than Ezra actually initiating this himself. It's a very interesting pattern. What else is interesting here?
People standing on his right and left.
Who are the people who are on his right and left? Why do you have an entourage, Ezra, during this public Torah reading? It's also interesting to see that we don't really know who these people are, with one exception. Chilkiah could be Chilkiah, who is the Kohen Gadol. That's not clear. He's not mentioned as Kohen Gadol here, but we do have a Chilkiah in that family. But yeah, these names. I mean, some of these names are names that have appeared in other lists. It's not like they're nowhere. But it's unclear who these people are, what their role is, that they should be standing up there with Ezra. Why is it that we emphasize Sefer Torah Moshe?
Gives it credibility.
Asher,
Asher.
Right, but why not just say the Torah? They call him and say, bring, not just any Torah, but bring us Sefer Torah Moshe. So what do you think this is, in other words? You're saying this may be the one surviving scroll, so the book of the Torah of Moshe, could be. Or could it be that this is the book of the Torah of Moshe? this is what we have as our tradition, this is Moshe's scroll. Like that, maybe that's what's going on. It's a very strange thing, and it's made more strange by the fact that later on we're going to drop these descriptives, and you'll see that people are going to listen to the Torah without that whole description.
But they established it, so
maybe once it's established, you don't need to say it again. Could be the location. Why this gate? Why do you keep emphasizing that? Why don't you just say right in front of the temple? Right? Why are you throwing in the water gate as though it should mean something to me?
I'm thinking of how where the gates are. Where's the water gate in terms of importance?
So it isn't a particularly, you know, it doesn't have a particular stature. What?
There's a tourist drop.
So we're going to talk about what happens through this gate. You know, what it is. What it's used for, but actually, the Dan Mikra notes. Go back to chapter 3, sentence 26 in Nehemiah, and we mentioned it once before in the construction of the wall. We had a description of the Shar Hamayim, and there in his commentary, he notes it's on the eastern side of Har Habayit, of the Temple Mount. So that we know. But I still don't know why this is such a big deal that you have to identify it as the place where they're going to do this Torah reading. So a few thoughts here. Number one, I think the idea of it being their initiative is very important. I think that's exactly the way Ezra does this. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I don't know what conversations he's having and whether he's sparking something, but fundamentally it is the nation that is responsible to make this go forward. That's number one. Number two, you notice the way they gather. We are told they gather ki'ish echad. So ki'ish echad in general in Tanakh as a phrase indicates unity, but also indicates speed. They all came together as one means really quickly. So for example, after the Meraglim, the spies, Moshe says to God, "V'heimatayas kol ha'am hazeh ki'ish es ha'am hazeh ki'ish echad," would you execute this entire nation as one man? Meaning instantly. In Shoftim, in the story of Pelegish Begiva, the concubine, when the concubine is murdered, and then they all gather to go to war against the city of Gibeah, it says, "V'tikohel ha'idah ki'ish echad." They all gathered again as one man. The idea is not only unity, but also in an instant. And we saw it actually in Ezra in chapter 3. After Zerubbabel's census, it said there as well that they gathered ki'ish echad, and that's what we're seeing here. And then the Shar Hamayim, this very interesting gate, this gate of the water. So on a simple level, take a look at source number 8. This is, Karen asks, what do they do at the water gate? Why is it even called that? Lama nikra shemo Shar Hamayim, Tosefta. Tosefta, remember, is a quasi-Talmudic text. It's from the same time as the Mishnah, which forms the building block of the Talmud, but it wasn't canonized in the Mishnah for various reasons. Either because it was felt to be redundant, there were ideas in the Tosefta that were already known, or because Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the closer of the Mishnah, didn't have access to it, or because there were questions about its authenticity. In this case, there's no question about the authenticity, really, of the contents of this Tosefta. It says, Lama Nikra Shmo Shar Hamayim, why is it called the Water Gate? Shebo Machnisin Sloches Shamayim Shal Nisuch Bechag. Because through this gate, they would bring a pitcher of water for the libations on Sukkot. As part of praying for water on Sukkot, we would actually take a jug of water and spill it on the mizbeach, on the altar. It's like you're sacrificing the water. So there was a whole ceremony to bring it in. That would become known as the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, this big celebration when they drew the water. The water gate is the place where you bring the water. Okay. I don't understand, because there were many gates, and each gate had a role to play. Why this in particular? So the answer may lie not in the technical, but rather in something greater. And here I will refer you to a sentence that I'm not going to have you look up in the interest of time, but it's in Zechariah chapter 14, sentence 8. Zechariah makes a prediction. He predicts that in the time of Mashiach, a stream of water is going to emerge from the Beit HaMikdash, from the temple. Now, we've all had that in our house at some point. But this is not a bad thing. This is not a leak. This is actually a good thing. Because remember, we've said it on other occasions, the main problem Yerushalayim has as a vulnerability is its lack of a water supply. And now Hashem is showing favor by giving you a supply of water with its image not only of drink, something you can drink, but also its image of survival, life, flourishing. It's going to come from the Beis HaMikdash, from the temple itself. And that's going to emerge from Shar HaMayim. The rest of the Tosefta speaks about it, that water will depart from there, beneath the threshold of the Beis HaMikdash. So Ezra is very familiar with that. Because remember that Zechariah is a contemporary. Zechariah is speaking in the beginning of the Second Temple, especially if this story took place in the earlier time, in the time of Zerubbabel. But this is a vision they would know. And so Ezra chooses the Shar HaMayim as a site that reflects redemption. Notice, by the way, this is one of the sources for our practice of doing Tashlich. The idea of going to the place where there is water for that prayer. There are a few reasons to do it, but keep in mind, what day are they doing this? This is Rosh Hashanah. And they go to the Shar HaMayim, the place of the water. So this is quoted as one of the sources for doing Tashlich at the water. There's much more to say about this whole story. We're going to have to do a lot more with it. So God willing, we'll pick up with that next week. And again, as I said at the beginning, next week we do have class, and then after that we're on break for Pesach. So we will not have on the 27th, and we will not have the first Tuesday in April, and then we resume whatever the second Tuesday in April is. The 10th? Okay. Thank you very much.